Welcome to Casterbus. My name is Christian Corley, and with me is James McLean. How are you doing, James?
I am fine, thank you.
Excellent. We are here, as you will have gathered from the title, to discuss The Box of Delights, which is 40 years old this year. Well, regards to the TV series anyway, it's 40 years old this year. Later in the episode, I'll be talking to Chris Chapman about the show and some of the DVD extras that he's been involved with producing. But first of all, we're just coming back to this, winding back to 1984. James, we've talked about 1984 repeatedely on this podcast. We've mentioned The Box of Delights as well. There was a discussion that we had in which I related that I think 1984 was, and the age of being 8 going on 9, as being the most important Christmas of childhood, where things kind of, you've got one foot in the magic and one foot in the sort of a wider appreciation of everything that's going on around you. And The Box of Delights was a big part of that in 1984.
I think when or if I die and I get to a flashback of my life, I'm going to be thoroughly surprised and entertained, hopefully, by all these podcasts we've done, which I have zero memory of. I'm tackling this 1984 as if it's the first time, this idea, and I like it. I don't know what I said last time, but I kind of like it. I think, yeah, that I like the idea of it being that, as you say, cornerstone of childhood, before sort of almost like childhood part two. So it's like childhood is Star Wars and childhood part two is kind of like the more edgy Empire Strikes Back is getting towards teenage. And then everything goes off the hill, doesn't it? And goes total Caravan of Courage, Battle of Endor as you get to late teens. Revenge of the Jedi is somewhere in there. I can't be bothered to make this analogy work. Yeah, 1984. Yeah, I like that. I mean, it's funny. I was saying to a colleague yesterday, I was saying just how I want to get an advent calendar this year, and I don't want to get one which has got any particular chocolates or has got any IP attached. I was saying this to Magnus actually. I just want as like a traditional old-fashioned twee advent calendar, because there's something about me which is so desperate to sort of capture the slow pace of Christmas when you're about eight or nine, mm-hmm. where, you know, that day one to day 24 is just a long haul. It goes slow. While these days, it just, because you're in work and you've got all this stuff going on, it just fires through. So things like advent calendars, things like, and I know we've probably talked about this before, I don't remember, but I know we have, you know, the importance of the TV times and the radio times, the importance of shows which carry these sort of memories of magic, like The Box of Delights, become more important, I think, as you try and find the brakes of life that you had when you were a kid, where the brakes were almost permanently on and you never felt like you were going anywhere. And you desperately want those now. You want to feel like you can just slow things down. I would be quite happy to potentially try watching The Box of Delights again, because I have good memories of it. I mean, you've watched it recently, I assume, so...
Yeah, I've watched it with my children a few years ago, and I'm planning on watching it with my youngest, because she's almost the right age to start watching it. In my context of, you know, I was 8 going on 9, she's 7 going on 8, so it seems like a good time for her to see it for the first time.
Did you not think that's a little weird? I mean, if you were... So 1984, so what was that? Is that... 40 years ago now, coming?
Yeah,
40
yeah,
years ago.
Yeah.
So what you're doing now as a father is if you were in 1984 and one of your parents turned to you and said, I'm going to try and subscribe to you the experience and events of 1944 as a way for you to grow up and feel how life should be, would you not find that a little bit creepy or weird?
You say that, but I sat with my dad watching things like A Matter of Life and Death, which I think is 1939, 1940. Lots of old Charlie Chaplin films. There used to be a lot of old films from that period on BBC Two on a Saturday afternoon in those days. So I don't think it's entirely unusual.
Yeah, well, my dad hated all that stuff. All right. He would show me Blackadder and the Young Ones and things that he found amusing. And yeah, he wouldn't tolerate anything black and white. As we've said before, I think Carry Ons are out the window. Don't watch that sort of stuff.
Right. It's
very specific, which is an interesting parenting style. So you're trying to replicate that magic.
Yeah, I think because, you know, when it was aired in 1984, and the book itself came out in 1935, so essentially the story is 89 years old this year.
Wow.
And it was broadcast between the 21st of November and the 24th of December 1984, which meant the final episode was on Christmas Eve. I think that was very clever scheduling, because it made the whole thing into a build-up to Christmas. And I think when you're rewatching it, it's very important to schedule it. And I have done this, yes. So that you're going to watch it weekly with the final episode on Christmas Eve.
Okay. You realise the 80s weren't great. It's not the... I know we all sort of go back to the 80s and sort of feel like this is a space to gift our children. But ultimately... weren't a great decade.
Well, do you know? Yeah, I mean, my feelings on whether decades are great or not, number one, not particularly important to this, I don't think. And number two, I think all the benefits that we've enjoyed over the past sort of 30, 40 years have been 90% due to the internet and developments around Silicon and the resulting businesses that sprung up and the benefits from those and how they've revolutionized how we work. So greatness it doesn't matter really, does it? It's a nice TV show.
But this is a bit of it, but the 80s was like, you know, TV was kind of, wasn't an era of greatness, I don't think. I think it was an era of a lot of rubbish and a few things popped out because they maybe just stood out a little from the rubbish.
Yeah.
Or alternatively, they were actually rubbish as well, but they were less rubbish than the other stuff which was on. Even things like when we talk about Doctor Who or Blake 7, you know, so many of those shows, their structure and their format and their, let's call it, charm, would come from the fact they had no money. You know, it wasn't a deliberate thing. It was how do we stretch out 20 minutes? We'll have a few more corridor runs, or we've only got two sets, so we're going to have a long bit of dialogue here because we've got nothing else to do. Mm. I think it's interesting, and again, I'm not attacking you on this, and I'm certainly not attacking the Box of Delights because I have very good memories of it. But there's always that little bit of worry about re-engaging with it and seeing it with, is it a less biased eyes? I'm not sure. Maybe they're biased in a different way.
Well, I think it stands up because they used animation rather than attempting to use any other type of special effects, really. There's a tiny bit of model work in there and a bit of Quantel paint box for some of the stuff, you know, the snow and stuff. And there's a bit of, but largely animation for the special effects, which I think gives it a kind of a dreamy quality, which I think works with it as well. The series cost £1 million, which is £3.23 million in 2023 figures, according to Wikipedia, which made it the most expensive children's series the BBC had made. It won a number of BAFTAs and RTS awards, mainly for special effects. And just to underpin and underline, the screenplay by Alan Seymour was appreciated enough that they cast Patrick Charlton and Robert Stevens in the two key supporting roles. Devin Stanfield plays the main character, Kay Harker. Now, Patrick Charlton, obviously, Doctor Who. Robert Stevens, obviously, great actor. And they take it totally seriously. The performances that you get from both of those guys, I mean, you know what Patrick Charlton's going to be like. Robert Stevens is absolutely seething evil throughout. He's sinister, he's nasty. I had nightmares about him. So I just feel that the Box of Delights, it deserves its reputation. And it deserves this 40th anniversary Blu-ray and DVD edition that's coming out on Monday, the 25th of November.
Do you think my memories of it, again, even as a 9-year-old, is it was quite a slow-paced show. Do you think, in a sense, going back to what I was saying before about that desire to try and almost decelerate the craziness of a seasonal period, do you think it fits in quite well in that sort of sense that if you're watching it, especially even as it, even for kids now, it has a bit of a slower pace, which kind of just because that's where I think Christmas and the season works best, and where because where it works worst is when it becomes frantic, where you're constantly having to go to the shops, where you're constantly having to work, where you're having to prepare for the holidays. The memories of it and the sort of notion of it we always have, and what adverts love to try and show as it should be, plus a switch or you know whatever they're trying to sell, is this sort of very slow-paced, gentle world, which kind of is, while Box of Delights isn't entirely a gentle world, there's almost like a I'd like to be there feel to it as well, as I recall as a car child anyway.
No, I agree. I loved the show. Do you know when it first went out, I missed the penultimate episode because we were Christmas shopping, and we didn't have a video recorder that year because we used to rent them from Radio Rentals or Granada.
As we did.
Yeah, as you did in those days, crazy
I mean,
times.
it's amazing what we complained about, you know, oh my God, now we have to subscribe to libraries for our material. Well, yeah, in the 80s, you kind of rented your video. You might rented your TV, absolutely.
So we were at Christmas shop, so I missed the penultimate episode. So I didn't see it till the following year or 2 years later when it was repeated. So I don't really know where I'm going with that, other than the fact that I did watch this, as I mentioned. I have watched it recently with my twins when they were about the same age that Daisy is now, 8, 7, 8, 9, and they loved it. I was surprised. I didn't think they would, but they really did. I think they got right into that world. And there is a, they've seen the Chronicles of Narnia movie, and there is a similarity with the train and Harry Potter as well, with the train and the accents and the setting. Not so much with Harry Potter, and I think that plays into it a bit as well. There's that kind of, the fantasy England world, to it, isn't
Yeah,
there?
well, that's interesting because I mean, one of the concerns I've always had about showing people younger than myself stuff from my old era is that you don't get much with those sort of paces. And as I've said, a lot of the time, the pace is due to restrictions. And if people in the 80s had the access to the material and the ability to produce as we have now, they would jump at it. You know, it's not like people, I doubt any of them would go, oh no, we don't want any of that stuff. We want to just struggle along with our limited ability, our limited abilities to translate and adapt fantasy works. But at the same time, that sort of pacing, which I find actually quite pleasurable to a lot of people I've shown older stuff to, they struggle with because it is slower paced. And we just don't do that anymore. Not really. I've like even like Doctor Who. I'm aware there's a lot of old, you know, and even old Doctor Who's a lot of long dialogue scenes. And I've seen people who are, I remember playing when I was in my 20s, late 20s, to people who were sort of late teens, and they were kind of like, you could see them switching off. So I find it interesting that, you know, your kids actually found that they didn't, because it is a very gently paced show. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in there, but it's still a part of its era. And it's kind of, I don't know, just nice to know that it can still be appreciated.
There is a nice group on Facebook, and I think this is one of the nice things about social media is Facebook groups about specific things, where you get a group of people who all like, it's like the old days of forums in many ways. You get a group of people who all really like something, and there's a lot of praise for it and very, very little, if any, negativity. There is a Facebook group for the Box of Delights, which I dip in and out of probably once a week, maybe twice a month, called the Box of Delights Appreciation Society. And it's just a very nice place. It has 3,300 members, although the posting is probably, I don't know, three or four posts a day at most. And they have an annual get together called Scrubble Fest.
Okay.
There's one in a couple of days' time. It's annual and just before Christmas. It's just lots of a group of people who really like the Box of Delights, and they're all very, very happy and jolly and about it, because it is a fun, and it's kind of a wholesome sort of adventure show as well. Of you've got that very basic theme of good triumphing over evil, and it's at Christmas, so there's, you know, you've got religious allegories in there as well, or certainly allegories concerning faith and tradition as well. And I think it resonates with a lot of people.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, for people looking to recapture their Christmas like me, certainly, I remember actually one thing I do really remember about it. There's two things I remember about it because I've not seen it in 40 years.
Right.
The two things I remember, one was obviously Patrick Troughton. Well, three things. One, okay, Spanish Inquisition, we're going here. Three things. One was Patrick Troughton being in it, and obviously Doctor Who being something that was quite interesting to me. So that drew me into it. Two was the fanatical devotion to the Pope. Three, I did have the book. I remember having the book of it,
yeah,
which was obviously the John Masefield book, but it had on the cover Patrick Troughton.
As I recall,
it might have the box as well.
I'm pretty sure it does. And it was abridged, though.
Oh, the book was abridged, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I didn't find this out until a few years later, but yeah, it's abridged slightly.
Well, that's a stunning shock, which has somehow broken my childhood. But okay, let me
sorry.
Just, yeah, okay. I feel massively cheated.
Yeah, I did as well.
From 40 years ago, that really annoys me. I don't know why. The other thing I remember was the box itself, which I actually remember being massively interested in and wanting a version of that box myself.
Yes, I did.
I remember going to some antique stores. I think we might have, I'm sure we've talked about Box of Delights before, and I've probably said this. There's looking for something similar to that, that my grandmother was trying to find me a box that would be, and I never could. And I'm assuming that box was tailor-made for the show, especially because it had electronics for it.
Well, do you know what? I got a watch that year, and this is so embarrassing. I used the, you remember when watches used to come in plastic boxes?
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to play the Box of Delights with the watch box. But just to make things slightly more nerdy, I made a papier-mâché button for the top of the box.
Yeah, that's sad even by 80 standards. I wouldn't want to be you as a 9-year-old doing that sort of stuff. Yeah. I mean, I think I had actually like an antique little box we got from an antique, it must have been a cheap thing. So it's made out of wood. But I remember it really well.
Hold on,
well.
Mine was DIY and I'm the sad one. All right, you spent money on yours.
Yeah, well, it wasn't my money. Two, if someone saw it in my room, they would just think it was some hand-me-down from a family. Well, when they go into your room and they see this watch box with a papier-mâché red button on the top, I think they'd get the suspicion there's something seriously wrong here. But yeah, so am I right in that, just having a look on the internet, that yesterday they posted that Box of Delights 40th anniversary airing confirmed by BBC4?
Yes, it's going to be on BBC4 this Christmas, starting on Saturday the 7th of December with a double bill of episodes 1 and 2, and then continuing weekly after that.
But the DVD, you say, is worth a consideration.
The DVD Blu-ray 40th Blu-ray. Anniversary edition. It's coming out on both. Yeah, it's definitely worth considering. It's got new features on it, including there's new trails and continuity, and a new hour-long documentary called Time and Tide, The Making of Box of Delights, which I spoke to Chris Chapman about. Chris Chapman, thank you for joining me. You're clearly a fan of the Box of Delights, and you're involved with a feature on the upcoming Blu-ray release. Is it coming out on DVD as well?
Yes, 25th of November, it comes out on Blu-ray and DVD.
I'm mostly interested in how you got involved with producing that feature.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it goes all the way back to the 80s, really. Yeah. Like, I was born in 81. So I think I probably was plonked in front of Box of Delights when it was on in 1984. I think that the amount of steam engines in it really appealed to my dad, who was a big train enthusiast, and the kind of British folklore magic stuff was my mum's cup of tea. So I think they both loved it and introduced me to it. And I remember we had a VHS taped off the telly version of it from the repeat in 86, I think, when they were hour-long episodes rather than the half hour. And that was the one that I grew up on. And I just wore out the tape. You know, it was that, and I think Mary Poppins and Dumbo were just on a permanent loop when I was four, five, six, seven. And it used to scare the shit out of me. I think with Box, there's something so... I genuinely think it's a terrifying, magical story with all these kind of haunting imagery, with Roger Limb's music score is so unsettling and strange. And you get like dream sequences in it, which I would say Rennie Rye, the director, is directly... He doesn't remember this. He doesn't remember thinking this. No. But they feel like direct homages to things like Father Carras's dream in The Exorcist, to the nightmare he has about his mum, and then the demon face appears subliminally. They do that in Box. Yeah. So, you know, you've got this thing aimed at kids. And I just thought it was wonderful. And watched it. And it made me... You know, I had a very emotional connection, I think, to it. And I loved Kay Harker, who Devin Stanfield plays. I thought, well, I thought I am Kay Harker. I really identified that adventuring young lad. And a lot of things from your childhood, when you're older, you go back to out of nostalgia and revisit. And maybe they let you down. Maybe you go, well, you know, it's okay, but, or they're just rubbish. And I went back to Box and thought, actually, this is really good. This is really, really good. And I still loved it in slightly different ways. But I could admire, I think, the endeavor of it, that every single BBC department is going at full capacity, you know, and achieving production values-wise, ambition-wise, is doing two or three times more than, say, Doctor Who was doing in 1984. And I love Doctor Who, but every single scene in Box is doing something special. And they had this £1 million budget, which was the biggest thing that the children's department had ever commissioned. And I look at Rennie Rye, a director, hungry young, early 30s director, saying, I kind of want to make movies, and this is my showpiece. You know, this is my chance to do that. So I love it, and I now I've lost my mum and dad, and so when I watch it now, I emotionally connect it very much to them, and I get quite, in a happy way, quite upset watching it. And about 2 years ago, I started saying to the BBC, 40th anniversary is coming up. They may well have thought to do something anyway, but I was certainly pitching and saying, you need to do something. The audience is still out there. There are still groups of people who watch this in weekly installments in the run-up to Christmas to mirror its original transmission. And I was saying, look, I just want to make a big film about this. I want to make like a big epic making of documentary like we do on the Doctor Who releases, but about my favorite thing in the world. And mercifully, they turned around earlier this year and said, go on then. And I got to do it. So genuinely, like the dream job, I mean, an eccentric, quirky, strange dream job, but the thing... If you'd said to me, age five, what would you most like to do with your life? It'd probably be this.
You mentioned coming back to it a few years later. I introduced my twin. I've got two twins. They're 13 now, but when they were about three, I thought maybe now's a good time. A bit younger than I was at the time. I was like eight. And so I plunked them in front of it, and they absolutely loved it. And I insisted on doing it the traditional way of making them watch it week after week after week. But they absolutely loved it. They still love it now. We've watched it not every year since, watched it a couple of times since then. And they're entranced by it. My youngest one, curiously, who really likes spooky stuff, she wasn't taken by it at all. No idea why not. But I totally appreciate what you say. When I sat down and started watching it again, I was thinking, this is clearly made in 1984, but it looks fantastic. You talk about production values. I would say, I mean, it's comparable to maybe one of the ITV Sherlock Holmes in terms of a period piece.
Yeah, and I think the biggest disadvantage it has these days, for somebody older watching it, is probably that it was shot entirely on video. Yeah. And the very practical reasons for that, you know, that allowed them to do the effects that they needed to do on location or in the studio, for everything to merge and meld together. That's its disadvantage. But I would say on the flip side, the ambition of the location filming, people talk about boxes and effects piece, but actually the fact that when they're on the railway at the beginning, that they've actually booked out a steam engine and they're filming on a moving carriage. And so often in telly and films, that would be rear projected or green screen or be in a studio wobbling about. The fact they do that stuff for real. Episode 6 is one of the grandest, biggest things I think the BBC ever did. That when you look at, you know, they have this huge exploding fiery set piece outside of Eastner Castle, and then to show Abner's dungeons flooding, they don't think, let's do that in a tank in Ealing. Yeah. They think, oh, well, they've got things that look like dungeons and St. Catherine's docks, haven't they, in London? So let's just flood them. Let's just, like, pipe in water from the Thames and flood them for real. And then you go from that to the filming, the shooting they did at Dudley Canal, where the kids and Patrick Troughton are wading through flooded tunnels, which they genuinely did, stood in a canal on top of like a little raised up scaffolding. And then they send them up a waterfall in a tiny little boat at the end, and it's all done for real.
Yeah.
And I just look at that and think, that's, I've said this before, but it's like the Apocalypse Now of kids' TV. It's got that kind of mad, wonderful, laudable ambition. I think those elements of it stand up incredibly well. And if you were doing any show now, you probably wouldn't think to do a lot of the things that Box did practically. You'd do them digitally, but I love that Box did them for real.
Yeah. I'm intrigued. You say you were three. We obviously discussed ages and things with my children. You rewatched it in 1986, so I'm guessing you would have been five, six?
Well, I think it was just permanently on in my house.
I see.
I suspect I watched it on first broadcast and have no specific memories of that.
Right.
But I suspect I was, from what I understand, I was plonked in front of it.
Yeah.
But I know I was watching the video version I had from 86, just onwards. And it wasn't a case of revisiting and going back. I would just have it on like once every couple of weeks for 3 or 4 years of my life. You know, it was on a continuous loop in my house.
You do remember stuff when you're three. I remember when I've watched Doctor Who, particularly the Key to Time season and the season after that. When I've watched them, thinking I'm watching them for the first time and remembering bits of them. So I know that I was watching the TV in like 1978, 79, at age three. With The Box of Delights, I was eight. It was 1984, so I was going on nine. I think 1984 is the best Christmas I ever had. Partially because of The Box of Delights. Also because I got Optimus Prime and Hound Transformers. There's a toy shop at the end of my road that sold the mini bots, so I collected a few with my pocket money in the run up to Christmas, and we had this marvelous Christmas dinner as well. And the whole thing was like the bestest Christmas ever. I believe the Box of Delights was part of that.
Yeah, and Box was episode six was on Christmas Eve that year. So, you know, Prime, Optimus Prime territory. I think that's the year when Optimus Prime is the toy of the year, isn't he? But he's like the Teletubbies of 1984, or the Buzz Lightyear of 1984. Yeah, and I think for a lot of people, there's something wonderfully Christmassy about it. I think it nails that thing that, you know, you'll get this in Doctor Who, like Stephen Moffat understands this, but that thing about Christmas, that it's lovely and warm and comforting, and also can be dark as hell and can represent loss and grief and sadness. And Box really gets that. You know, I think that the ending when they arrive in story, it's Tatchester Cathedral, it's Hereford Cathedral in real life. When they come together there, I'm not a religious God-fearing man, but when they sing "Come All You Faithful" and all the lights suddenly, because the power's gone, then all the lights come back on as they're singing that, and they've won, they've triumphed over evil, I just think is the most Christmassy thing ever. It has to be that sense of coming out of the, you know, coming out of the darkness that makes that work. I mean, I kind of say to people that, you know, some people said, oh, it's, I think there is a comparison with something like Harry Potter, which can be a dirty word these days, of course, but I think there's an element that it shares with Potter that this is life or death. That if you're, you know, this was being written by John Masefield, 1930s, first publication, equivalent to like Enid Blyton writing Famous Five, Secret Seven, Five Fine Doubters. You know, there's never a sense, I love Enid Blyton, but there's never a sense in the Famous Five that Julian, Dick, Anne and George, or even Timmy, are going to get killed.
No.
They're getting in this trouble. They're going to stop the smugglers, but the smugglers aren't going to murder them. You know, the worst that can happen is they could get a telling off from the police or stuck in a cave for a couple of hours or something, get dripped on. But in Box, there's a genuine sense that, that these children might die and that they've somehow found themselves in the middle of this kind of battlefield between good and evil, which is what makes me think of like Harry Potter, when you've got in this story Cole Hawlins, played by Patrick Troughton, on one side, and Abner Brown, Robert Stevens, on the other. And they're not messing about.
No.
You know, there's this real sense of this is something eternal and brutal. And that, as with all the best kids' stories, maybe children see things in just a slightly different way and can kind of unlock something that grown-ups kind of miss and don't really understand, don't know what's going on. So I love that side of it completely.
So the Blu-ray and DVD are coming out on November the 25th, and you've produced a brand new special feature for this. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. So it's called Time and Tide. I did ponder calling it Time and Tide and Buttered Eggs, but it's a bit long, isn't it? So we shot on that, Time and Tide, the making of the Box of Delights. And very much, I mean, it's the biggest thing that we've ever done, really. And if anybody watches our documentaries that... I have a company called Moon Balloon, and we do a lot of stuff for the Doctor Who range, and we've done Blake Seven as well. It's bigger than anything we've ever done before. That's pure self-indulgence. That's purely me going, I really love this. I want to do something big. So we interviewed 25 of the cast and crew, which we've never done 25 new interviews for any film that I've made. And it runs to an hour 41, which is longer than anything we've done. Yeah. It's a big story. And there's even in hour 41, there's bits I had to leave out, you know, that I was like, oh, I could tell all those stories too, but it would then be 2.5 hours, you know. But it's an epic. And it, I guess, fundamentally is the story. We follow Rennie Rye, the director, and Devin Stanfield, who plays Kay. We bring them back together.
Okay.
You know, you're talking about a director in his early 30s who cast a 12-year-old boy. So there's quite a connection between them, and they lived through a year of this production back in 83, 84. And so their reunion, their partnership is kind of the heart of the film. And we take them back to a number of the different locations from the show as a way of exploring it. And they're supported and supplemented by like 23 other people from the cast and crew, all kind of sharing their memories and so on. And I think I find it very emotional to watch. I think it kind of hopefully builds up to something that you think, well, that's the best possible celebration we can have of this show. But I was just really happy to do it. I spent the whole time in the interviews just kind of grinning and loving meeting. I think particularly when you do something where there have been child actors in a show and there's an element of meeting up with them as grown-ups, and them looking back on a childhood, a really vivid childhood experience. There's something quite profound and interesting about that. And from a viewer point of view, it's just fun to go, oh my God, they're grown up, you know, and that's certainly an element of it as well. But no, it's been a very busy time, but it's been an incredibly fulfilling time working on it.
Now, obviously you've produced a lot of these extras for DVDs for the BBC over the years. And you said that this is like the biggest thing you've ever done. So what without getting so bogged down in kind of logistics, how long has this taken?
This was actually fairly brisk. I mean, I wouldn't change anything. And I'm delighted with how it's turned up. But I think we've done this all in about 12, 13 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And that's on top of other jobs, you know, other commitments that we have. So not clearing the decks 12, 13 weeks. But yeah, it was ultimately fairly brisk, and you know, that's sometimes a good thing, because it kind of certainly focuses the mind. I was in a lucky position that I already knew everything about the show that I needed to know at the outset. You know, I was familiar enough to be able to jump in, and I reached out to a number of significant people in the Box of Delights kind of fan community to say, you know, what we need first and foremost is to get in touch with people, to get in contact with cast and crew. So we built on a lot of existing relationships, you know, a lot of existing contacts that were out there. We didn't try to reinvent the wheel. But mercifully, I think everybody involved, we've had a huge amount of positivity back from them, because I think for those people, this was a really memorable job and this was a really happy job. So there wasn't an awful lot of persuading required, like with most people. And so it's come together fairly nicely like that. Sometimes with these things, it can be the tracking down of people that is just the unknowable. It's like, well, if I can't find Kay Harker, do I have a film? Is there going to be a film without Kay? And mercifully, I keep saying mercifully, but it does feel like that we got all the people that we really wanted. So that was great. That's on this good. One.
Yeah. Is there any surprise appearances that we can look
I think loads. I don't want to ruin it, but I genuinely think if you have any element of the show that you love, that is your thing that you love, I hope and suspect it will be in the film. So if you're like, oh, I love that character, as long as they're not dead, as long as you're not like, I want the dead guy to turn up and tell me about it. But obviously people like Patrick Troughton and Robert Stevens, we massively still talk about them and pay tribute. Even people like Julian Sands is in it as Greek soldier number one. And, kind of famously, we lost Julian earlier this year or last year. So it's a chance to pay tribute to those people who have gone. Mm. But I think any fan of the show, if you thought that's my favorite bit or that's my favorite character, I think we'd have a moment in the doc that kind of either reintroduces you to them or revisits that place or pays tribute to it. So I think it's all in there. And the lovely thing about it is there are artifacts of the box of the show that have survived.
Right.
That are featured in the film. And I don't want to spoil that, but when people watch it, they will be like, holy shit, how has that survived 40 years? And there's a lot of paperwork and storyboards and some behind the scenes footage that I don't think has been widely seen before and things like that, that I think, I hope it will be a treasure trove. And it's certainly, I've kind of made it for me thinking as a massive fan, what would I love to see or to understand or to learn about? And unlike Doctor Who, where people like, the Andrew Pixleys of this world, the Richard Bignalls have been researching for decades wonderfully. And we've built up this understanding so that even when you do a making of about Doctor Who, a lot of the audience already knows, they've heard some of those stories. People talk about them at conventions and there's a bedrock there. With Box, the BBC, the written archives in Caversham that we always go to for Doctor Who, for whatever reason, there is no file on Box of Delights.
Wow.
And it's probably something really boring, like just a producer, a production secretary not passing on the paperwork. Usually it's call sheets and memos and in the main. But they didn't have that. So we were really coming in with nothing official on the table. And it's very much an oral history like that. And wonderfully, actually, along the way, one of the participants, it turned out, had squirreled away a full production file. And didn't realize, they were like, I've got this, by the way. Is this helpful? I'm like, yes, that's helpful. Yes, I will scan this all. And I'll share that with the written archives and pass it back. But I think it was quite refreshing and liberating to come in thinking, we're kind of telling a lot of these stories for the first time. Now, some cast and crew have been interviewed on podcasts and so on before, but I think we've spoken to a lot of people who have never been spoken to before. And to build it all together, to use them as an ensemble, supporting each other, bouncing between them, I hope it's the definitive version of that. And without being too morbid, we're 40 years on, mm-hmm. we've lost some of the cast and crew already. I think if we were doing this for a 50th or 60th anniversary, it would be a harder film to make. So I'm glad that we've done it now because it feels like we've been able to really capture those voices now at a time when you can have a really big film celebrating this amazing time.
Was a DVD already planned for the 40th anniversary? Because I know that things are difficult to persuade at the best of times, but a 40th anniversary is a big thing, but also there's quite a lot of distance between 1984 and 2024. So what level of convincing was involved there?
I think someone like the BBC always loves an anniversary. If you're releasing physical media, I think being able to say it's the 40th anniversary or the 50th anniversary is an extra hook. I think in a big sea of, we could release anything, why don't we release it? It's helpful to be able to peg it to that. And I think logical for an audience to go, I know why they're doing this. This makes sense. I can't really say how much persuading was required because I genuinely don't know with the BBC. There may have been whole factions of the Beeb saying, oh, we should do this. We should really do this. So it may have already been a plan, but I certainly know that I pitched to say we should do this and this is how we should do it. And they came back to say yes, please. So, you know, it's hard for me to know the inner workings, but I'm glad that I pushed for it. I'm glad that I hopefully was a kind of persuading voice to say, you know, this is valuable. And certainly I think they know how much we throw ourselves into the Doctor Who docs.
Sure.
And I can only imagine they probably thought, well, you know, we can imagine, you know, I think Chris will probably do something quite big and grand for Box of Delights. You know, that this would be, because you want to give people a reason to say, I know I've got the DVD. Do I need another copy of it? And I hope seeing it on Blu-ray, the team remastering that, plus the documentary, and I know there's some new continuity trails and things like that on the set. But I hope, you know, the documentary, as I say, is an hour 41, so it's a fairly, if I was a fan, if I was just a customer, I'd feel absolutely charmed by that, that I would think, yes, I want to see that, absolutely. So hopefully.
That Facebook group for the Box of Delights is possibly the nicest place on the internet. I absolutely love it.
Yeah. The Box of Delights Appreciation Society, isn't it?
It's just so nice and warm and encouraging a place. There's a few other places, actually on Facebook as well, some of the retro gaming places I go to, but it's just a lovely little community.
I think so, and I'd been aware of them in the past. I think I was already a member, just as a fan of the show. Not a very active member, but they I think, as you say, it's a kind of a broader church than, say, Doctor Who as well. There's a real mix of people of different, not necessarily different ages, because most people are people who were there in 1984 or soon after in some way, but a real mix of people from lots of different backgrounds in that group, not the hardcore nerdery that people like myself represent in Doctor Who fandom. It's a little bit broader, and they have these lovely events. Not only, you know, do they share stories about rewatching the show every year, but they do a thing called Scrobble Fest.
Yes.
Scrobble Fest every year, the group organizes it, and they go back to locate, you know, it's the kind of thing I can get behind. They go back to locations as a jolly and as a way of exploring Box and its legacy. And they've been incredibly helpful on this, because I immediately got in touch with them, and I've tried to be quite open on the group talking about the doc as soon as it was announced, to say, you know, as you would to any fandom, you're like, we're doing this for you guys. You know, this isn't something that's being thrown at you. You know, this is something that's grown from your love of the show. And so they've been very helpful, and it's very what's the word? It's comforting, but there's something very good natured. There's something very homely about. Although I do see there is another group called the Real Box of Delights Appreciation Society. And the splinter group now, which is almost like the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea from Life of Brian. But I think all amicable as far as I know. I don't know. It's nice. One of the things I'm actually really looking forward to, kind of perhaps this is ego, but I quite like the idea of seeing how the doc goes down on a group like that, on a very vocal group. Now, I will have to resign myself from, you know, getting involved with that, because obviously some people may hate it, and it may have big rants about why did they not do this. But with all these films, particularly when they're not for broadcast, you know, if you can see, I think it's really important to see how the fan community reacts to it, because those are the people you're doing it for. And if you make something and they just kind of shrug, give a collective shrug, you kind of think, well, what was the point of that then? So it's important to me to know that the film has succeeded in what it set out to do, which is to please them, really, and please people like me.
Chris Chapman, thank you very much for taking the time out to speak to us on Cast Erebus about your feature Time and Tide for the Box of Delights Blu-ray edition, coming out on the 25th of November.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Christian. Lovely to chat to you.
You too. Thank you. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that interview with Chris Chapman. Thank you very much, Chris, for joining us there. And by the time you listen to this, you will be able to purchase the 40th anniversary of the Box of Delights on DVD, alternatively on Blu-ray. And we'll be back for a new edition soon. As it's nearly Christmas and you're going to be watching the Box of Delights, hopefully, Merry Christmas.